In spite of the difficulty of this task, I welcome the chance to provide a glimpse of a historical perspective, possibly informing the conversation around a bishop being relieved of residential responsibilities to perform denominational-wide service. While our corporate memory cannot tell you what is the right decision to make, I hope it will inform that decision and that you may have some interest in the historical memory bringing us up to this moment. I am also realistic about the varying degrees of interest around our history. As well as the fact that it is 4:15 in the afternoon. Each one of us makes decisions about our own lives based on memory and experience. Sometimes we reject or repent of what has been done. Every time I sing, Lift Every Voice and Sing, I pay close attention to the verse where it says, Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Or in the third verse, Out of the gloomy past, till now we stand at last. But there are other times that we embrace our memory and we celebrate the fact that we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. A personal example. My parents required me to commute to college in order to save dormitory costs. I wanted a different experience for my daughters and told them that they would live at college unless they strenuously protested and wanted to live at home. They did not protest. I hope I can provide some background that will indicate that discussions of leadership and effectiveness and management are not new. I have been drawn to Ecclesiastes as I have listened to the conversation about change. It is not a popular book of the Bible and maybe is too fatalistic or deterministic, but chapter 1, verses 9 to 11 has caught my attention. I don't think these will become popular verses. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, See, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them. That may be just a bit too somber for a Florida afternoon or too contrary to all that we have been hearing. Issues of leadership and management have been a part of our life from the beginning. With John Wesley, there wasn't much need to debate because he led and managed and completely controlled the life of the connection. He wouldn't dare take the title of bishop because of the Anglican context of the movement, but he certainly functioned as one. And he ordained persons in 1784 and authorized Coke to ordain when coming to America. In 1789 and 1790, Asbury created what was known as the Council, consisting of bishops and presiding elders whom he alone had appointed, as a way of correcting the cumbersome nature of 11 annual conferences that had no unifying structure. Such a concentration of power was short-lived, and ultimately gave rise to the quadrennial general conferences beginning in 1792. The council is a piece of our history that should not be quickly overlooked. The model of episcopacy lived out by Asbury was itinerant and imperial. He traveled and he was in charge. The McKendry model, on the other hand, was a collegial style. Kenneth Rao, in a lecture, stated, The new bishop consecrated in 1808, Virginia-born, who had been Asbury's assistant in Kentucky, had his own ideas about the nature of the Episcopal office and introduced several innovations designed to soften the inherited imperial style. Bishop McKendry insisted on collegiality among bishops. He forced Asbury to share authority and power. For McKendry, the Methodist Episcopal Church would have no one bishop in charge. He delivered the first Episcopal address on the state of the church at the opening of the General Conference 1812, acknowledging his new role and upstaging the aging Asbury, who was not happy at that innovation. McKendry began consultation and appointment making, and he introduced administration by Episcopal areas by suggesting to Asbury, "You take these conferences and I'll take those." Well, a later bishop wrote, "Perhaps Bishop Asbury visited more annual conferences than we do, but presiding in an annual conference then was a much lighter task than it is now. We had not a dozen associations whose complicated machinery requires several days to adjust and keep in proper order. Now we have so many things before us at our conferences that it is impossible to do anything well without a longer time than we usually bestow on any one conference." Bishop Andrew, January 1859. Now, I can only mention that the Methodist Protestants had no bishops, the British Methodists do not have bishops now, and that we should become more familiar with the Evangelical United Brethren understanding of the episcopacy and their experience with term episcopacy, but 12 minutes doesn't allow any more in-depth around those parts of our history. 1964, the Coordinating Council, which no longer exists, brought a report about the general superintendency to the 1964 General Conference, which included legislation that permitted a one-year church-wide assignment and included a suggestion that the Council of Bishops might give sincere consideration to a full-time executive officer. So we're not dealing with a new thought. In 1968, there were efforts to relieve the secretary of the Council of Bishops from residential duties. And the Council of Bishops took to the General Conference a petition in the form of a constitutional amendment. It was sent on to the annual conferences for action first, where it failed to receive the two-thirds vote. This was at a time when the secretary of the council served a four-year term, as is still the case, and the president, however, served a one-year term. The secretary served as the ecumenical entry point and was considered head of communion for ecumenical issues. Strong secretaries in that era included Bromley Oxnam, Roy Short, and James Matthews. What I found more interesting from that time were two addresses at the November 1967 meeting of the Council of Bishops as it looked forward to the union with the EUB Church. The point is that 45 years later, the comments sound so current and familiar. W. Kenneth Goodson gave an address entitled, "What Leadership Can the United Church Expect from the Episcopacy?" He enumerated five criticisms of the council. And to all of my bishop friends here, these are not my criticisms. They're Kenneth Goodson's in 1968. One, that the Council of Bishops does not take sufficiently aggressive lead in the affairs of the church as a whole. Two, that it does not do a sufficiently effective promotional job. Three, that it does not move ineffectively with reference to situations obtaining in society in general. Four, that it does not speak to the church often enough or with sufficient clarity and effectiveness on current conditions, current concerns of the church and of society. Five, that it has not found ways and means to administer unitedly the total church, which is to say that it does not move in as a council on the particular affairs of episcopal areas. Each bishop and episcopal area are remaining largely units unto themselves. And he laid out the need for a set-aside bishop. On the other hand, Bishop Fred Hollowell delivered a paper on what is the future role of the bishop. The one sentence that caught my eye was, "I must say that I believe that we should give more attention to our own areas and less to the idea of general superintendence." And so the debate went on. 1972 to 76, there was a study committee on the episcopacy and superintendency, but I found there little that was worth including in this very brief survey of our history. in no way undercutting the value of reading those long and detailed reports. 1988 to 89, Council President Jack Toole appointed a committee to study and make recommendations on council leadership structure, and they called for a set-aside presiding bishop of the church, not to take the secretary of the council, but the president of the council. The report was not approved by the council. 2001 to 2003, it was dealt with again, essentially calling for the 2004 General Conference to put in the appropriate legislation that a bishop could be set aside for 4 years and also having the necessary constitutional amendment. It had strong support in the Legislative Committee and seemed to have strong support on the floor of General Conference until the General Secretary of the General Council on Finance and Administration raised financial concerns, and the motion to refer was adopted by a small margin, and so it was referred to somewhere. You don't know how much I appreciate that you can still find humor in all this. History does not prescribe a particular course of action, but that does not diminish its importance. Each of you must decide if the needs of the church today call for one bishop to be in a role not yet experienced in the church. Just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. Just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it should be done. It is up to others to anticipate what may be the benefits or the unintended consequences of this change. All that can be said from our heritage is that it is a departure from the practice that developed after Wesley and after Asbury and largely through the influence of William McKendry. I'm quite sure that a set-aside bishop will not pretend to be either a Wesley or an Asbury in our midst. Strong leaders have emerged without this office existing. Bishops such as Otterbein and Seibert, Simpson and Haven, McConnell, Clare, A.P. Shaw, Oxnam, Corson, Matthews, Escher, and Debs. Kenneth Arrow said in a lecture, "We Methodists need not at all be ashamed in confessing our grateful pride in our Methodist heritage. But it is just this pride and gratitude that should prompt us to strike for an equally open and hopeful future. We may be about to do a new thing, or it may be only the latest expression of seeking inspirational leadership, a compelling vision, and effective management so that Jesus Christ will be made known, and the love of God and love of neighbor will increase in the world." I resonate to the poetry of Natalie Sleeth. From the past will come the future, what it holds a mystery, unrevealed until its season, something God alone can see.
As you have heard from the very beginning, we've had, as the people who follow the Wesleyan theology and the dream of the movement of John Wesley and Francis Asbury, an uneasy relationship with bishops. You have already raised some questions that we hear constantly. The authority of the bishop. Term limits. The issue is the leadership that moves us toward accomplishing the mission. How shall we get there? Let me preface just a few remarks that I want to make in sharing with you some of the thinking that has come as we have studied, prayed, talked, discussed, debated, prayed some more in bringing forth a proposal for the president of the Council of Bishops to be relieved of residential responsibilities for a period of 4 years. First of all, to remind you that we have a mission, and the bishops are absolutely sold on the mission, making disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. How do we do that? We believe we do it through vital, healthy, thriving congregations connected one to another in the common mission field of a community, of an area, of a country, of the world. The adaptive challenge that has emerged out of the call to action and out of the work that has been done over the last quadrennium states it very clearly. Our challenge is to redirect the flow of attention, energy, and resources toward an increase in the number of and sustaining of the number of vital congregations. This should not surprise us. It's not new. It's already in the discipline. In the paragraphs about the local church, we read already that the local church is the place where disciples are made. So the bishops are in moving toward an emphasis on providing that kind of leadership that encourages, inspires, motivates, challenges us to be about the mission of the church. Second thing I want to say is that the discipline and our Constitution says that the bishops provide spiritual and temporal leadership for the whole church. The 400 paragraphs that describe the work of the bishop describe a manager, not a spiritual, temporal leader of the denomination. How do we do that? We're living in a world, and most of us who are sitting in this room today, all of us who are bishops, have been engaged in studies with Ron Heifetz and adaptive leadership. We understand that the hierarchical world does no longer exist, that command and control does not work. The opportunity to provide a president of the Council of Bishops relieved of residential responsibilities is not about power, authority, hierarchy, command, and control. It is about mission and vision and challenging the church to move forward in accomplishing its mission. Third thing I want to say, and then just a couple of other words about this. I'm finishing 2 years as president of the Council of Bishops, while at the same time providing leadership, residential leadership, for the Western North Carolina Annual Conference. It has become, in this flat world, nearly impossible to be president of the Council of Bishops, receive the demands, the requests, and assorted other things, and lead an annual conference at the same time. We have tried to address that through the Council of Bishops by having an ecumenical officer, a retired bishop who serves in a part-time capacity as the ecumenical officer. We've had over the years some strong leaders who've been in that position. But as we've been saying earlier, it sends a very confused message to the ecumenical community. Who is head of communion? Is it the president of the council? Is it the ecumenical officer? Is it GCCUIC? Who is it? Right now, Bishop Rader, Sharon Rader, is our ecumenical officer. She and I communicate a lot, and we get invitations to be present as the United Methodist at tables. And sometimes it's Bishop Rader, sometimes it's me, sometimes it's somebody else we have designated. There is no consistency and there is no clear message to the wider world who United Methodists are. Do we want the bishops doing that? Discipline says that's who we are. We are ecumenical leaders within conferences, within the states, and certainly within the broader world. We've also decided that we needed help. We have an office. We have a full-time secretary, administrative assistant who's in the office. And then we've got another retired bishop who is the executive secretary of the council and helps move through some of the paperwork and some of the many requests, reports, and other matters that have to be tended to. Were it not for those three people, being president of the Council of Bishops and being a residential bishop of an area, would absolutely be impossible. The kinds of requests and demands to travel, to itinerate, to speak on behalf of what the Book of Discipline says and who we are as United Methodists and what our Wesleyan heritage is and the uniqueness of our mission and ministry demands more time and energy than one can do in what is, in essence, a job that requires a lot of time. Finally, the president of the Council of Bishops as we have begun to think about what that's going to look like, has an opportunity to help shape the entire council around the adaptive challenge. The bishops have said, we're focused. We want to expend our energy, our resources, our attention on developing, nurturing, increasing the number of sustaining vital congregations. To begin to organize the work of the Council of Bishops, to begin to have conversations across the entire church. We understand what it is to work collaboratively, collegiately. It is not as if we would be the Council of Bishops or the President of the Council of Bishops or any other group in any kind of hierarchical standing over anybody else, but a way to pull us all together so that we move forward toward the mission. Serving in those kinds of capacities, encouraging spirituality among the bishops, encouraging levels of accountability. One of the lessons that I have learned as president of the Council of Bishops is how little power, authority, permission I have, the bishops have, to hold one another accountable. I cannot tell you, let me put it this way. There has not been a month in my almost 2 years now as a bishop, as president of the Council of Bishops, when I haven't received a letter from some conference somewhere in the world wanting me to fix their problem. I write them back and refer them to the discipline. The response is usually, I know what it says in the discipline, but you're the president of the Council of Bishops. Fix it. Well, we have mechanisms for all of those pieces, but the bishops have no way of holding one another accountable for their work. To move to the accountability, as we heard just a little earlier this afternoon, for the jurisdictional committees on episcopacies and central the conferences outside the United States being able to ask for and evaluate and hold bishops accountable for more than just the appointment process, but how we are moving toward the mission. My friends, my sisters and brothers, it is all about the mission. And how do we help churches move forward in accomplishing the mission for the glory and the sake of Jesus Christ?
Thank you, Bishop Goodpastor and Reverend Williams. We will now take time for a few questions from the floor. Just feel free to go to a microphone, and I will call on you. If you could please remember to state your name, your conference, and whether you're delegate, communicator, staff, whatever your role is. Thank you. Yes.
Sorry, my leg's fallen asleep. Not that they weren't very, very interesting presentation. Randall Miller from California, Nevada. So, Bishop Goodpastor, I have a question for you, and it really is a serious question, and I don't mean it disrespectfully. So, if you take the whole of the call to action proposals and look at the proposed role of the Council of Bishops, it seems to me that one of the things that's happening is that there's a pretty significant strengthening of the role of the Council of Bishops beyond just this particular piece of legislation that we're talking about. And I'm glad for the historical perspective, because it seems like my understanding of our polity has changed, that our polity really doesn't have as much sort of continuity as I thought. But I wonder if the Council of Bishops is aware of this, what seems to be a significantly strengthened role in the life of the church, and in the spirit of sort of taking small steps, whether it would have been better to sort of carve off a smaller piece and then live with that a while and go bigger.
Thank you, Randall. I think if you read the call to action report and some of the recommendations from the interim operations team, and proposals going forward, there are actually fewer bishops involved at the general church level in the future than are now. And that was purely intentional. Not that it increases the role or strengthens the hand of the bishops, but it is, and Bob referred to this earlier. One of the questions and one of the issues we struggle with as a council of bishops, I see many of my colleagues here, we have this conversation a lot. Are we diocesan bishops or are we bishops of the whole church? Well, one of the things that the call to action is inviting bishops to is to be held accountable in the areas where they serve, more so than maybe even now. The number of bishops who would be assigned to various general level committees, commissions, boards, whatever we end up calling them, would be far less than they are now. And I don't think that weakens or strengthens. I think it focuses the mission where the adaptive challenge is calling us to, and that is creating the increasing the number of vital congregations and understanding that connection is not about what we have at the top being pushed down. Connection is what happens church to church to church, community to community. And if you in the history, one of the geniuses with Asbury and the others were the way that those local churches, societies, and bands connected around a common mission. And I think that's the dream and the push. Hope that gives it some of that.
Ellis Conley, clergy delegate from West Virginia. My question is not... currently, bishops are elected in jurisdictions. I would assume that if a person became a set-aside bishop or chair of the Council of Bishops, whatever phrase is chosen to be used, that would take place at General Conference, and at that jurisdictional conference cycle, then another bishop would be selected or elected at that time and assigned in that jurisdiction. My question is, when their season of assignment as the chair of the Council of Bishops, president, whatever, is completed, and they go back to a jurisdictional pool of bishops to be assigned. Now, if bishops happen to be retiring that time, that'd be a perfect fit. What if there's not? What kind of process have you worked through to deal with that situation when it arises?
Thank you. I think one of the ways Amy answered this earlier up here on the panel was, you know, part of the adaptive challenge, part of adaptive leadership is you learn as you go, and you figure out how this is going to happen, and you respond to what's happening and moving forward. We have talked about that. We've talked about it also, all of us here, we've talked about it in terms of, will the president of the Council of Bishops, and the phrase that I've been using, I think, as we've been writing it, is president of the Council of Bishops without residential responsibilities. Just trying to describe it, not like the Lutherans as presiding bishop or the Episcopal. I mean, there. What happened? Will there ever be a president of the Council of Bishops from outside the United States? Because elections and processes are different in different parts of the world. And so the answer to that is yes, because we believe that we would have to do this in anticipation, so a couple of years down the road, so that everybody could make the necessary adjustments, appointments, and elections as we go forward. So we've tried to address some of that. Some of it, I think, is going to happen as we live into it. And we understand that it's never been done before.
I tried to separate.
Yeah. Actually, Wesley did it and Asbury did it, but, you know, that was by default, I think.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, two of those questions are part of the question that I was wondering about, and this sort of flows into tomorrow's debate about the whole call to action report. But with Bob up there, a common lover of history and our polity and our doctrine, I'm concerned or just really questioning the balance of powers. You know, we've had a love-hate relationship, as you've already alluded to, Bishop Goodpastor, with bishops, and a lot of these things have been voted down. And part of that stems back to our history, part of our experience with Asbury, part of our experience with McKendry. And McKendry was a part of the 1800 schism with James O'Kelly and the power of bishops. And from my understanding, all of our schisms, all of our splits, except for the racial ones, have been about the balance of powers between conferences and episcopacy. O'Kelly's thing was about Bishop Asbury's ability to appoint people wherever he wanted to appoint them without any sort of recourse. The Methodist Protestants, their dislike of bishops. And even the 1844 schism was not just about slavery, but also most historians say, and Bob, I want you to help me out, that a lot of it was also about the power of the General Conference to suspend a bishop. So things have tilted one way or the other, and we've had splits because of it. Now, I'm looking at the guide that was presented to us by UMCOM, and on page 16 at the top, it says, all bishops, active and retired, attend the conference, meaning General Conference, but do not vote and may not speak in plenary sessions without permission from the assembly. And I know that paragraph 427.3 says that bishops have spiritual and temporal authority, but I also know paragraph 509 says that only the General Conference can speak for the denomination and have control over all matters distinctively connectional, paragraph 16. So we've got this weird dance going between episcopacy and conferences. So what say ye about what this might do in terms of upsetting that balance? Some of what the brother over here was getting at in terms of what this does.
Yeah, as I've looked at and been in all these conversations with laypersons, clergy, and bishops, I think the fascinating thing to us is the way General Conference tries to reserve or does reserve its particular role. And we bishops understand that we'll be sitting somewhere voiceless at General Conference and then be asked to live out, fulfill, obey whatever the General Conference says. I don't think those balances of power change at all. I don't think any of us saw it that way. We understand who we are. We are United Methodists, and our system is that the General Conference speaks for the United Methodist Church, and the bishops are called upon. I mean, we've said this numerous times just in my years in the council. You know, the discipline says this. This is what we're going to do. We will uphold the discipline. I think one of the things that impacts how we go forward, I love history too, and I kind of reading back through all of that. But this world is different. This makes it different. The number of cell phone users on the continent of Africa has gone from 100 million to almost 500 million. It means that this flat world needs a different kind of leadership. I was reading an article coming down today that was referencing this kind of world and suggesting that the next decade or two, this was in an article in the latest issue of Fast Company, the next decade or two will be defined more by fluidity than by any settled paradigm. And so, partly to anticipate call to action tomorrow, but I think also the bishops are trying to understand that the world of 2012, 16, 20, and 24 is not the world of 1844. And the number of delegates who will be at General Conference from outside the United States and how we lead and provide leadership for the church across the world demands a different kind. However, I think the General Conference will reserve for itself that balance of power, and the accountability will be there.
Yeah, I know we're getting to the time, but there's just a couple impulses that I find just are a bit too great not to comment on. Really appreciated the comment on how fluid our polity has been around the episcopacy. In spite of the third restrictive rule, which says we cannot do away with episcopacy or alter our itinerant general superintendency, we need much more discussion around that tension between conference responsibility and general superintendency and what that looks like. Truly, the world has changed, and your eyes would glaze over if I did a 100-year lecture on that gradual transition that we are far removed from an itinerant general superintendency and what that means. The only other comment, and I always feel when you're trying to give a historical perspective, you put your own opinions aside. But if that's done, I just want to keep in our mind that everything is true about the world being different. I've read the world is flat. It is different than 1844. But I can't help but think that the deepest needs that we have of the soul are no different today than in 1844 or in the day when Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount and came into people's lives. That has not changed and will not change. And I just begin to get fairly passionate that when I have sat with a person at their moments of grief or of celebration, what is in the human soul still needs the same healing and the same balm that's in Gilead.
Amen.
We probably have time for one more question, if anybody else. Yes, over there. Sorry.
Unlike the prior speaker, I'll identify myself. Of course, we all know that was Reverend Tim McClendon from South Carolina. Good to see you, Tim. I'm Jay Brim, conference lay leader from Southwest Texas. We heard in the report from the previous panel on the study of ministry some interesting comments about the use of the jurisdictional committees on episcopacy. And it seems to me that if indeed this office that is being suggested is a sort of whip for the Council of Bishops, that the president of the council would be someone who would help all of the members of the council reach out on the adaptive challenges and meet all of the challenges of today's church, that perhaps that position, if it were adopted along with the changes that are being suggested for the episcopacy committee for each of the jurisdictions, that there might be some inner working there where those committees could call in the president to assist, perhaps, where there is someone who is not responding to the gentle nudges that may come from our committees. Is that a possibility?
I think we've tried to shy away from using congressional political words like whip and majority leader and minority leader.
Yes. I mean, one of the things we've talked about in terms of this president of the council is recovering some of the itinerant nature of the general superintendent, freed up to go visit jurisdictional committees or visit with bishops in other parts of the world. My colleagues who have preceded me, Bishop Palmer, Bishop Huey, Bishop Weaver, we've all been caught up in situations where a trip to Africa, a trip to the Philippines, a trip here, in order to work with bishops or work with conferences and churches and leaders in those areas. And it's a very different world outside the United States. And right after the Council of Bishops met in November, 3 days later, Thomas Kemper and two others, Cynthia Harvey and Caroline Njuki and I traveled to Cote d'Ivoire and had a very different experience of being received as a bishop in those but there was a reason for being there. Now, it took me out of Western North Carolina a week. So I can't do that a lot because the commitment and the discipline and my personal commitment and the commitment from the Jurisdictional Committee on Episcopacy and my own conference episcopacy committee is, we need you here. So
Yes. In the current configuration, it would be very difficult to do.